Hi, I'm Gary Duncan, the Executive Director of Worldwide KFUO. Thanks for listening online to our programs, our stream, our podcast, our online on-demand audio. We appreciate you. Remember, KFUO is a listener-supported broadcast ministry, so we do rely on your support to continue. So please prayerfully consider making a gift today. You benefit from the programs, and you know how important it is to get the message out to the world. And that's what we do every day here at KFUO. For more information, you could call area code 314-996-1518 to talk to Mary, or 996-1520 to talk to Mark. Ask them about the different ways to give to the ministry of KFUO. Thank you in advance for your support. Also, tell your friends about us. Most important of all, pray for the ministry of Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and it's time for our daily lectionary study today. As our guest from Lititz, Pennsylvania, Pastor Adam Kuntz, pastor of Mount Calvary Lutheran Church. We're going to be looking at Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 to 12, coming right on the heels of our text from yesterday. This, of course, is brought to you by the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. You can find them at lutheranfcu.org. And if you have a question or comment about today's text for myself or Pastor Kuntz, you can call us 1-800-730-2727, or even better, tweet me at Rev Fisk. That's the at symbol and R-E-V-F-I-S-K. I'll take your tweets live on the air and pass them on to Pastor Kuntz or answer them myself. Welcome, Pastor Kuntz, to the show. I'm glad to hear your voice again. Adam and I go way back to Philadelphia when he was really, I guess, just coming into Lutheranism, and now he's a pastor serving the church. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you? I'm well.
Excellent. How are things in Pennsylvania? I haven't been there in a long time, but you went back.
they're very good. We have a really great congregation here, and we're trying to start a new congregation in Lebanon County, just to the north of us here. There's very few LCMS churches out here, as you know.
So what is entailed in that? Is that a full mission plant? Are you doing sort of like an intentional split with the congregation? How are you guys going about that?
Yeah, it's a full mission plant. We have a few members who live up there about half an hour north of us. But, it's mostly all new people. So.
Ah, cool. That's fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so that we've been running out of time every time we've been going through these Revelation texts. That they are so chock full of stuff. So we should probably dig right into this one, although it's shorter than the ones we've been looking at. We've been looking at whole chapters, and today we only have half the chapter. Even so, it's a disturbing chapter. But before we get to it, anything about its context, about the book of Revelation in general, about the lead up in chapter 8, or anything else that the listener needs to know before they would just kind of open their Bible and start at Revelation 9?
Yeah, Revelation is written to encourage the saints who are suffering under persecution. So I think it's important to remember the purpose of the book whenever you're reading it, is that it's written for the comfort of the saints. Who bear testimony to the Word of God and to Jesus. So that's the purpose of the book. John is generally pretty explicit about his purpose in writing, also in his letters and his gospel. So the other thing would just be a quick hermeneutic thing. We take the Bible at its word. We don't take it literally, in the sense that we're always looking for one-to-one correspondences. So many Christian interpreters would see the locusts in today's text as something like helicopters or something. That's to take the Bible, maybe you could even say woodenly. We want to take it the way it's meant, and we're going to see a lot of signs both in the rest of Revelation and here in Revelation 9 that it is meant to be taken symbolically of other realities going on, particularly here, I think, spiritual realities about false teaching. So.
And we've been trying to highlight this repeatedly, that it has a special genre called apocalyptic literature, which was unique to largely the intertestamental Hebrew people. But it was normalized for them. It was something they did. They took images from the Old Testament and they used them to talk about things in the present. And this kind of arose when they were under oppression. It was a way of having a code language that wouldn't necessarily let the oppressor know that they were writing about things against what the oppressors were doing. And right. for that reason, things are symbolic. I always find it hilarious that those who would want to read the text woodenly would somehow come to today's text and think it's helicopters, because that's just beyond. They're actually running back into a bizarre symbolism, almost an allegory of sorts, as opposed to yeah. Right. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. I think that the assumption that folks who would think that the locusts are helicopters have is that the explanation for Revelation is somehow contemporary political events rather than images in the Old Testament, which is really, if you read Revelation, it quotes the Old Testament more, I think, than any other New Testament book. That's really the key to understanding it, not contemporary politics.
Well, what you just said there is something I think I've tried to say, but you think you said it better. The key to many present-day readers of Revelation is contemporary political events, as if there's some sort of guarantee we're going to find this in the present right now in a way that's different than you would have found it then. And what's so important about the book is if they could understand it then, or that they could. The first readers knew what this book meant.
Right, which is why it's important to remember the purpose, because you see that it's for their comfort, for their faith, for their strengthening, and for ours, and not simply as a key for our understanding what's going to happen next in the Middle East.
Yeah, right. Which is strange how it always does seem to revolve around the Middle East. I guess Jerusalem is there. But whenever we have these various conflicts, whether it's Iran or Russia or wherever, right. The TV evangelists will often switch who's who, right? And so trying to pin the tail on the Antichrist, as I like to say. And it really can't be done, especially when, as we're going to see today, I mean, the word Antichrist doesn't really show up in this book, but we do have this demon from the bottomless pit. We're going to see he's not incarnate. He's an angel.
Right.
Well, if we start at verse 1, I don't think we're going to get very far without having more context, because it says, and the fifth angel blew his trumpet. So we know there's four angels that came before this. And the thing about trumpets, anything on that?
Yeah, there are pronouncements of woes. What's kind of interesting is that at the end of where you guys finished yesterday, you have an eagle specifically crying out about the blast of other trumpets, almost as if the 5, 6, and 7 will be somehow worse or more intensive than the previous ones. I don't know if you can really say that when you go back and look at 1, 2, 3, and 4, a third of the sun, the stars, the water being destroyed, the sea turning to blood, but it is in a series, and I think the important thing there is that, as we're going to see locusts, that it comes in a series of plagues or woes upon the entire earth in the way that back in Exodus, the plagues came in a series upon Egypt.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I think also then recognize, so you have these seven trumpets that are the second of a series of sevens. So you have three series of sevens, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven censers that are going to come later, or bowls of incense, bowls of wrath, ultimately. Right. And I think they help, or there is help for understanding what's going on in them when you stop trying to read them as a series of things in order. And if you were to take the paper and like lay it out as a flat paper and cut the paper right where the sevens end and then put them on top of each other and read down through them, in a vertical level, it's a very non-Western way of reading. But I think they kind of open up for you to see what's going on in them. And so in those first four trumpets are connected to, I think, the first four seals as well, in which you see basically the destruction of the earth as we know it, the fall, the curse, death, war, all that kind of stuff, and that life on earth becomes unbearable. And now with this shift to the fifth, we're moving into a bit of a spiritual reality, particularly in the trumpets. We're going to see the hosts of darkness.
Right, yeah. The fifth trumpet, this is actually specifically not going to harm the earth, and we'll talk about why that is.
Yeah. So a star fallen from heaven is what happens after this fifth trumpet blows. Yeah. And he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. A lot of language there, even in the Greek, abyss, right? The bottomless pit, the abyss.
Right. Yeah. So already he is referencing Old Testament texts. You can go to Isaiah 14 to look at the star fallen from heaven to earth. identified there in most translations that anyone would use as Lucifer. This is definitely a spiritual being. He has agency because you see he was given the key to the shaft at the bottomless pit. And he has command over the bottomless pit and abyss. If you go back to the Greek Old Testament, is going to be identified with hell, with Sheol, with a place of punishment, a place of darkness, of exile. So somehow he's going to have control over it in some way. An important thing for the saints suffering either in John's time or in our own is to know that he was given the key, meaning that he does not have power that is not given to him, and so his power can also be taken away.
Yeah, that's absolutely key. So with that key, no pun intended, with the with that then, though, he does use it. Verse 2, he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given the power like the power of scorpions on the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but will flee. Death will flee from them. So he opens the abyss. He opens the darkness, you know, the spiritual realm of all evil. And you got first, before you get the locust, you just got this smoke coming up. And the Hebrewism is smoked with a great smoke kind of thing, right?
Right. Smoke, I mean, there's all kinds of references that you can think of here. You could think of the smoke ascending from Sodom and Gomorrah. You could think of the way that the locusts in Exodus 10 obscure the light because of their number. Locusts always come in giant hordes when they come in the Old Testament. Look also at Joel. So there's an obscurity and what is naturally given for good, which is the sun, the lights to mark the seasons, is gone and is obscured and cut off by this giant horde that's now coming.
On the people that in darkness sat, right, a glorious light have seen. The darkness is this, I would contend, this spiritual rule that Satan is given in the fall, and that's what I think John's talking about here, over the age that we live in. And the songs, the prophecy from Isaiah about the light returning is not the light of the sun that comes to save us, but Christ himself returning with God's word, right?
Right. So I think that verse 4 already tells you that this is spiritualized in the sense that when locusts come, if we're talking about actual locusts, their whole point is to destroy every green thing. You know, if you look at Joel, that's exactly what's reported. They destroy every green thing. That's what they do in Exodus. They are commanded by someone, they were told, not to destroy the grass, the green plant, or any tree, but they're actually going after people. So these are definitely figurative locusts in that sense. They are symbolic of someone who is destroying the spiritual life of a human being, not a locust or a black helicopter, whatever,
right,
whatever you're looking for.
Yeah. We're definitely going to see that in the later verses that this is they're demonic, they're demons, and their description is quite horrifying. But as you say, they're not allowed to really harm the physical world. God is, I mean, we've seen that the curse in the first four trumpets harmed a third of everything. The physical world's not what's supposed to be. It's not totally destroyed. It wasn't 100% gone, but a third gone. A big chunk of what life should have been is just kind of not here. We don't experience life as God originally designed it. But this, they're not allowed to really do more than that. They're only allowed to harm. Now, particularly, it says, those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. We've talked about that seal earlier in chapter 7, and we made some connections to baptism. You have to make a few jumps to get there. But at the very least, it's talking about they can't harm Christians. This trumpet can't touch a Christian.
Right. In the same way that, you know, the biblical plague upon Egypt was meant to punish idolaters and to mock their God. This spiritual harm comes to idolaters who are not sealed by God, who do not have God's protection in suffering.
We skipped over the power, like the power of scorpions of the earth. And that's kind of a strange thing, too. I mean, it already is getting at what he's going to do later. I think this is important to say that the images that John is putting together here are not meant to actually make a picture. Each one of these images is meant to give you a feeling or an edge. And when they pile on top of each other, you don't end up with a drawing that you could put in a movie. You end up with an impression of what's going on. So you have the idea of the locust that is something that comes to destroy things, and the scorpion, something that causes great pain. And those two things are together with the darkness of this spiritual age that can't harm the earth, but harms all non-Christians. Any other thoughts about scorpions there?
Right. Yeah, scorpion. I mean, Jesus explicitly associates scorpions with demonic activity, their sting. I think it's in Luke 10, maybe. Scorpions are seen to be demonic. They live in the wilderness, and they are just horrendous-looking creatures, which is exactly what the locusts will turn out to be, too.
Well, I guess you mentioned the wilderness there. For the Hebrew mind, there were two places that were considered the haunt of great evil. One was the sea, the chaos of the deeps. But the other was the wilderness, the haunt of jackals, as it was called. Both of these places are where the demons live. And it isn't necessarily that demons actually just live in the wilderness, but again, in a picture way, the barrenness, the chaos of the sea, these things that are in the earth as we experience them are what the demons actually are doing in the spiritual realm.
Right. And when locusts come, they make a green place to be like a wilderness. So that's important to remember when they come to humans.
Right, right. So they're taking what was perfect in paradise, and by our subjection to them, turning us into, sufferers, not in a good way. And that's what's going to happen now, I think, in 5 and 6 a bit, that they are allowed to torment for 5 months, but not to kill. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. It's hard not to think about the current euthanasia debate when I read this verse, right?
Yeah.
That people are trying to die, that they really don't like being here. We do everything we can to live as long as possible until we don't want to, and then kill me now. And that is the spiritual darkness.
Yeah, there's no question. I think, verse 6 is beautiful in kind of a dark way. The way that John writes it, people will seek death and will not find it. That they long for things that they cannot attain, as dark as those things may be. And I think that the torment, I mean, what drives them to that, and one of the motivating factors behind pushing for euthanasia is the torment that people endure in spiritual darkness, because we're not saying that all physical suffering is foreign to Christians. You've seen earlier in Revelation, you've seen the martyrs at the very least. So there is physical suffering. John himself is in exile. The issue is how you will deal with the suffering that does come your way, whether because of the testimony of Jesus or because if you are a non-Christian, the way that these demons, these locusts, have come to you and made your life miserable. So,
last piece there before we go to a little break, back in verse 5, that this torment lasts for 5 months. I connect that to the earlier statement about it was silent in heaven for about half an hour. That is, it's not a full time. No one does something for 5 months. It's incomplete, but it's smaller than a lot. And so this is like the current age we live in that's still under the fall. Christ is reigning, of course, but the darkness continues for a brief while, long enough to be bothersome. Thoughts on that? Am I on with that one?
5 months is also the length of the dry season. So it could be that this is simply... But this is amped up because the locusts are not kind of coming in and out. They are tormenting them continuously for the length of the dry season. So this is a supernatural suffering.
Right. Okay. So it's, again, doubling down then on this suffering that's happening. We're going to get more of that on the other side of this break when we look at what these locusts look like. You maybe want to keep your children away from the radio. It's dark. We'll be back. This is His Time on Worldwide KFUO.
Hi, this is Pastor Harrison. Let me tell you about something new and exciting. We call it Life Together, a monthly digital digest where I'll be sharing news and highlights from Synod publications and multimedia outlets. There'll be something for everyone. Each digest will be delivered to your inbox, showing how we live and work together to proclaim the gospel and bear Christ's mercy to one another in our congregations, communities, and the world. Please be sure to subscribe today. You'll be glad you did.
We're still in Revelation chapter 9 here on His Time. On Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, this study is brought to you by the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. You can find them at lutheranfcu.org. We did have one person write on Twitter. Anastasia says, I am really glad I have the seal of Christ on me after hearing about the scorpions. It's kind of a good news thing there. Continuing on then, especially, it's going to amp up what that is, the appearance of these locusts, these scorpion-like locusts. But I forgot to mention, my guest, Pastor Adam Kuntz of Calvary Lutheran Church in Lititz, Pennsylvania, is with me, talking again about Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 to 12. Picking up at verse 7, it says, in appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lions' teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses running into battle. Now, it's not done yet. It's going to keep going, but we got to stop there. It's like too many pictures to hold them all together in your head. You really got to take them, I think, one at a time and ask, what is the one point of reference that John is trying to teach us about demonic power?
It is that it is monstrous, that it looks horrendous, but is very powerful.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, some of these comparisons are drawn in the Old Testament itself, that locusts are like horses somehow. They're called hay horses in German. I know that. They are monstrous. I mean, I don't want to go through each of the images yet, but yeah, go ahead.
Well,
horses prepared for battle. These are rushing. This is a comparison that you're also going to find in Joel, where the comparison between an invading foreign army and the locusts is so near as to be confusing. Are we talking about locusts? Are we talking about an army? They're coming to destroy the way a foreign army would come into Israel on horses. On their heads are crowns, which means that they are not acknowledging the power of the king, whereas the kings of the earth will cast their crowns before the Lamb. These ones bear crowns. They believe that they have authority and rule. They try to maintain their own authority. I think the point of comparison, the point of contrast would be the living creatures who worship the Lamb earlier in Revelation. That's the nearest comparison. This is kind of like the demonic opposite of the living creatures who worship the Lamb.
That's interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit more? That's fascinating.
Yeah, the living creatures look kind of, they definitely look strange earlier in Revelation. There's no question about that. But they have a precedent in Ezekiel for dwelling in the presence of God. This is like 4:7 down to the end of the chapter. Those living creatures look strange, but the precedent in Ezekiel means that they belong in the nearer presence of God. Not that the nearer presence of God and the worship of the Lamb is always, comfortable for us. It still might be strange and awe-inspiring, but they worship the Lamb and they give praise to Him, and they're not wearing crowns and they're not there to destroy. In 9, these creatures also look very strange, but they explicitly come to destroy, not to worship.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison. I've always kind of seen those living creatures as being connected to the creation, because it's the number 4, which is about the earth in Old Testament kind of numerology, right? And you have all of creation represented, at least in the animal beings,
right?
From the lion being a wild beast, the ox being a tame beast, the bird being like the fish and the birds on a different day of creation, and then man over them all. But certainly, you're right. Though, I mean, there is a comparison. You got the lion and the human, at least, on the same creature. What I was kind of seeing here, too, so you're spot on with the horses prepared for battle. They're an army. They're coming to conquer. Crowns of gold. They are taking authority, whether or not it was given them or not. They're exercising authority. Their faces are like human faces. And so there's something about them that is I don't know, akin to us, that we would find normalizing in some way, and even to the level where their hair is like women's hair, which, biblically speaking, is a sexual reality. They're attractive. There's a lustfulness about them, and yet you get too close, and what do they got? Teeth like lions' teeth, right? It's like the sirens on the in the Greek mythology, that they lure you in with their attractiveness, and then they eat you.
Right. Falsehood always appears to be attractive on some level. I think it's really important to understand that things that would draw us away from Christ always appear in some fashion to be good, beautiful, or true until it opens its mouth.
The breastplates, like the breastplates of iron, then, is, we can't defeat them, in a sense, right? They're greater than we are. They're stronger. The noise of their wings, like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into the battle, they are so powerful that we would be overwhelmed. It makes you think of Luther's hymn, A Mighty Fortress, right? On this field of battle, we'd be soon defeated. Soon were our loss effected, as the old translation says.
Right. Those breastplates of iron and chariots with horses are also examples of military technology that Israelites did not possess in any kind of great numbers and often didn't produce themselves. So when you see it, it's like a sense of helplessness that they're coming at you and you cannot stop them. You have no means of stopping them.
Hey, you're dressed in a cloak with a staff, right? And some guy with an iron breastplate and a horse pulling a chariot is coming at you. What are you going to do?
Yeah? Right, exactly. Yeah.
You're going to run or you're going to submit. You just have no way to fight back. And it's not done. There's still more. They have, verse 10, tails and stings like scorpions. It was mentioned earlier, but repeated again here. And their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. And let's stop there before we go on to the final piece here. So referencing what happened before, again, they are able to bring suffering, but this isn't physical suffering. But it is truly the ability to hurt us. And we shouldn't diminish the, it's more than anxiety, the despair of the ever-present human quest for self-justification, how people are always putting on a good face, trying to appear that they're winning the war for life, and yet inside, everybody's fighting a battle you don't know about, and it's not a good one, it's a losing one, they're suffering deeply, and the reason is because of our subjection to this spiritual darkness.
They inculcate a desire to be something and to long for things like death, which cannot be here fulfilled, like we saw in verse 6. That's far different than what Christ does when he inculcates longings for heaven or for blessedness that he will deliver on. But demons also give people longings and desires that either destroy them or themselves can never be fulfilled. So they're always false teaching, always involves false promises too.
Right. It always involves more talking. You know, don't listen to God's word. Words don't even make any sense, but I'm going to tell you all about it and give you my own words to believe anyway. Kind of the postmodern tripe there. So finally, and we're not done with this guy. This guy's just beginning in the book. Verse 11, they have as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon. It's again one of those verses where it's like it's so beautifully dark. This is better than any fiction novel you could ever pick up and read. It is so poetic and strong and yet horrifying. Just absolutely horrifying.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the king over them. Now this is actually kind of strange because literally, proverbially, in Proverbs 30, locusts do not have a king. So the idea, I think it's 20, verse 27. Their king either is self-appointed or, at the very least, you could say he is unnatural, but yet he has a supernatural power over these demonic forces. So there's, again, whenever we're talking about demons or the demonic or the unchristian, we're talking about authority that is arrogated, that is self-assumed, that is self-maintained. Think Herod instead of Jesus.
Right. No, that's really fascinating. I didn't know that. And so you got contrasting them with their crowns. I mean, locusts don't have a king. They don't have authority. They are just ravaging everything uncontrollably, eating whatever they find. And yet they're claiming some sort of authority for themselves. And then there's one that would set himself up as their king to rule over them. And he clearly, I think the reference here that The angel of the bottomless pit. This means that angel, that star that fell from heaven, that did open the bottomless pit.
Right.
So he is their, if we can call it this, their liberator, or maybe their enslaver, pulling them out of where God had set them, stars in the sky, it will mention another place, and sending them upon the earth as ravagers. And then the meaning of his name, right? Abaddon and Apollyon, both words from the original language. And sometimes I guess here I'm not always a fan of transliteration, of bringing the word directly across to English, because it kind of helps to know what it means. But here it does say Hebrew versus Greek, but then it never translates it for you. So anything about Abaddon and Apollyon, what that meaning really is?
Yeah, the meaning is destruction, or the one who makes others to perish. Apollumi has to do with perishing in Greek. So he is the one who brings utter destruction. I think a lot of us have probably would resonate with the mental image of the evil wizard letting the orcs out of Mordor. You know, this is right. This is exactly what's going on. He has control over this vast army of people. And I think that the interesting thing about the crowns on their heads is that there really is no honor among thieves. Just because he is their king does not mean that they acknowledge him as such. In fact, they're all wearing crowns. So they have some kind of authority that they believe they have for themselves, but yet they are controlled by this one who has authority over them. It's really very sad the way that authority is set up in ungodly situations where everyone is striving for it and no one is happy.
Yeah, we should maybe come back to that in just a minute, because it's so connected to our again, ever-present quest for self-justification. But I want to just emphasize again the way you said that so well about that, translating these names and how it fits into everything you could imagine about a great story, that the bad guy isn't Darth Vader. The bad guy is named Destroyer, or if you prefer, One Who Makes All Perish, right? And that's right. What they call him, right? They don't even bother to symbolize it in any way. His name is just Destruction. And that is who Lucifer, this fallen demon, fallen angel, become demon, this one serpent, dragon, who we'll see later, who lured Eve into temptation, and then Adam joined her willfully, who now is the prince of darkness, the prince of this present age. That's who he is. And he is the, what's the word now? The antagonist of this book, against whom Christ, the victorious king, who we've already seen, strong, wounded, dead, but now living, he's gonna finalize this. He's going to bring to bear. He tied up the strong man. He's going to bring it to bear on him by the end of the book.
Right. Yeah, just a little note, I think the reason that he includes Hebrew and Greek, I think Hebrew is a reference to destruction that would be understood by some of John's audience. Apollyon is similar to the name Apollo, and that's not a coincidence. And there are aspects of Apollo where Apollo is a destroyer. It's also helpful to know that Roman emperors would often portray themselves as Apollo,
right,
or would be portrayed as Apollo, so that the demonic earthly authority and worship of demons is very important here.
Well, I would say I didn't know that either. That's really helpful in that later, an alliance between this angel, later called a dragon, and a beast out of the sea, which is really the Roman Empire preparing to persecute the church at that very time, is made. They ally themselves with each other. And so here now, that same alliance is hinted at, in that the name of this fallen angel is the name that the Caesars would take for themselves to claim godhood, right? Which then gets us back to that authority issue. You know, we got a few minutes here to kind of burn on this.
Sure.
The lust for authority, or the belief in power, which kind of is at the heart of our fall, who we are. I mean, some people talk about, well, you know, what is the real original sin? Pride. Some people will say power. It's really unbelief. But that unbelief is an unbelief in God that then trusts in something else. And that trust is in my own godhood, my own ability to be good, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important to know that unbelief leads necessarily, in Adam and Eve's case, to a desire to append godly authority. So I think that our contemporary world is very good at recognizing abuses of authority. It's something that we're very concerned about, and rightly so. But the Bible doesn't replace ungodly authority with no authority. It replaces it with godly authority, which is why Revelation is so concerned to, as you said, identify the true, the godly, the righteous king who will come in and destroy his enemies by the breath of his mouth. So I think that that's not at all to take away from the definite reality that our world is very much alive to today, that authority can be abused so massively in so many ways, and it does make people desperately unhappy, as you saw in verse 6.
It's one of those bizarre realities, though. You can't abuse something that's not good, right? You can't. Evil doesn't have the ability to do anything by itself. It has to come along something good and corrupt it. Is insubstantial. A little philosophy involved in that kind of thinking, but I think it's really spot on. You know, to have the devil, you need an angel before he's the devil, right?
Right.
And so the same goes for all the gifts of God and the fourth commandment, which teaches that God built authority into creation through father and mother initially, but that it also extends, and we know this from Paul, into the vocations of husband and wife, into the vocation of employer and employee, and the vocation of king and people. This isn't a bad thing. We're burned out against it because bad men, us, abuse these things. But I think Christianity would teach us to rediscover and to find that the mercy that we're given, of course, can infuse these things with a new idea that the authority is actually for the good of the one you're over.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the culture wants to tell us that Christians are repressed, that they are miserable, that they're denying themselves some kind of freedom that they should have. I think it's important to understand that what the devil does here in being an angel who wanted to be something he was not and then fell, he creates in verse 6, he creates the same dissatisfaction with life and God's gifts that he himself has. So he wants to make us like he is. Which is what idols always do. Those who worship them become like them. So he wants us to have his demonic dissatisfaction.
That's so interesting that the most you could ever get, you know, you kind of see the movies that they think, oh, I'll sell my soul to the devil and I'll get all I ever wanted, but all you're ever going to get is dissatisfaction because that's all he has to give. Oh, wow, what a fascinating idea. Just a few minutes more here to kind of finish up with verse 12. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. I mean, how bad can it get?
It can get very bad because John wants to show different facets. And like you said earlier, what he likes to do is pile pictures on top of each other rather than explain something once. I mean, he writes in the exact same way, especially in his letters. He likes to return and circle back and show you a slightly different aspect of something that you looked at 5 minutes ago or 2 hours ago or whatever. So it is helpful, and you said this already, not to see these things as necessarily chronological. That's where a lot of Christians kind of go astray in Revelation, is mapping onto the Bible a chronology, a scheme that isn't actually there. He's not saying this happens in some kind of chronological sequence, but simply in order to order his pictures, he's going to number them in this way.
And all of it a setup too, right? You said this when you started it, and it's always worth reemphasizing. So he's got seven trumpets. They're kind of all bad until the last one. And then the last one, especially here, is still, it's a woe because it's a destruction of the world at God's hand. But this is being done by Christ the victor, who has redeemed the world. So as dark as it gets, the darkness is there so that it can contrast with the light that he's going to talk about every time he shows you Jesus.
Right. Right. And it's also, I mean, it can't be stressed enough that for the saints, the destruction of their enemies, the destruction of Apollyon, the destruction of those who worship him and who are like him and who persecute them, that is good news. So God's salvation involves the destruction of his enemies and the salvation of those who love him and long for his appearing.
That's another piece that it's good to remember from yesterday. This entire set of trumpets is a response to the prayers of the saints. This is what he's doing because we're asking him to deliver us from evil. This is what he's doing. That's his answer.
Right.
My guest, Pastor Adam Kunz of Mount Calvary Lutheran Church in Lititz, Pennsylvania. We've been looking at Revelation chapter 9 with our daily lectionary study brought to you by the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Adam, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again.
All right.
We'll be back in just a minute.